everyone, and welcome back to the Narnia Web Council. I'm your host, Rillian, and today we have Jimfan joining us. Hello, Jimfan.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am doing fantastic.
That's good.
But now we're going to discuss a somewhat more gloomy subject.
Which I'm sure we can all agree on.
Well, it's interesting. We're going to try to cover the Lone Islands portion of the movie today. There's a thread on Narrowhaven in the forums that you can go to, and I think a lot of people, whether they overall liked the film or didn't, were kind of disappointed by the Lone Islands.
I don't think it was more being disappointed by the Lone Islands itself, but what happened at the Lone Islands is sort of, it's kind of hard to forgive, and that was, anyway. We'll talk about it more as we go on.
Yeah, well, I'll just open up with a quote from Destrier Dragon. She said, "Overall, I did think the film was good, but one of the most disappointing scenes for me was Narrowhaven. Apparently, the Lone Islands adventure, which involved our heroes being abducted, sold as slaves, being bought by one of the lords, deceiving the enemy, faking military strength, fantastic dialogue, and a great old governor character, as well as memorable repeaty moments, was not epic enough." Let's go ahead and just jump in. And picking up from last time, we have the crew still on the Dawn Treader. They've just sighted land. Edmund and Caspian are looking through the telescope. They don't see anyone. Ed tries to give some orders, but Drinian reminds him of the chain of command and that he has to follow what Caspian says. And so then Caspian gives the orders. I don't know, as far as just, not a whole lot here, but as far as character development, I guess for one thing, you had Drinian putting down Edmund, which I didn't like, but also you had Edmund just being really peeved that Caspian's in charge, it seemed.
Yeah, it was a bit of an awkward scene. I understand what they were getting at. They were setting up the whole Goldwater scene where Edmund is feeling like he's not being appreciated.
Right.
And that Caspian is lording over him. I see that that's what they're trying to set up. But it was, I don't know, I think it could have been done in a way that was better. There's something very awkward about it.
Even if you're going to go that route, and you know, I'm not a fan of that route for character development, but it can be done well. And let's say you go that route. As I was watching the movie, I remember thinking, ah, yes, a character development moment. You know, it just seemed forced, whereas, you know, character development should feel really natural. And I think I've been spoiled because I just got back from the cinema seeing The King's Speech twice.
Oh, that was an excellent movie.
Twice in theaters, and it was fantastic. I really hope that it gets Best Picture and that Colin Firth gets Best Actor. But anyway, that was just a little moment that kind of took me out of the film a little bit, where I thought, okay, character development moment here, you know. Take notice. But they go ashore on the lifeboats, or rowboats. They're not really lifeboats. And they're startled when they hear bell sounds. So Caspian loads his crossbow, which I thought was kind of an interesting touch. Just because, you know, I was like, oh, yes, a medieval rifle. And he says, if we don't return soon, send a search party. And so they go up to the bell towers. And then, of course, we have the whole scene where they're captured. Well, I mean, there's quite a lot here. But what are some of your thoughts or impressions on the scene? I mean, first of all, why, the pretense of them going on the islands, it's a very different mood than it is in the book.
It's very, like, they sense that something is wrong from the get-go. Whereas before, they suspect that they may not be very welcoming to the King of Narnia. But they don't really expect that anything bad is going on, like slavery. Whereas in the movie, right away, they're looking at the island. Something is not right. So it has much more of a suspenseful feel, almost. You know, if that makes sense, because they're going in with their eyes wide open.
They're armed, for one thing.
Yeah, instead of just traipsing through the field and being caught completely off guard. So it definitely changes the tension of the beginning of the Lone Island sequence quite a bit.
Yeah. I have to say, in some ways I don't mind this particular change. Because in the book, of course, an author is able to say, if Caspian, looking back, and if he'd been a little more experienced, he would have known this was a very foolish idea to do this. If you're trying to establish Caspian as a credible leader, in a book you can say, ah, yes, he made a one-time slip, but you can kind of convey that he's still a competent king. But here, I understand saying, oh, yes, he's a king, he's going to be taking a little more precautions because he is mature and he is a capable leader. So I understand that. I didn't mind that. It was a little bit weird that if he really did think there was maybe a threat, then he would have probably gone on with more men. So there's some, there's a little inconsistency there. But in a sense, I didn't really mind that change so much.
Right.
They go on with a very different attitude.
And it makes sense in keeping with the overall character arc that they've had since Prince Caspian, that Caspian in the movie Dawn Charter would be a bit more world-wise than Caspian in the book, because in Prince Caspian the movie, he has been through a lot more than Caspian in the book has.
I noticed he's saying Caspian. Prince Caspian the movie.
Caspian. I did not. Anyway.
Yes, you did. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, that's just what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
You can't expect Caspian from Prince Caspian the movie to be completely innocent and naive and whatever, because that is clearly not who he is, at least in the movie. Book character is a little different, but in the movie.
Yeah, so that I didn't really mind so much. In many ways, watching the Lone Island scene, really up to the point where they're captured and such, I was kind of enjoying it. I thought it was going fairly well. I overall kind of liked the scene in the bell tower. I thought, okay, it's a neat environment. Yes, the sword play was even worse than Prince Caspian. Lucy is like, I guess I'm kind of jumping ahead to the Narrowhaven scene. I'm thinking, whoa, don't let this little girl punch you. She'll knock you on your head over heels. Wow, she's one hit. Boom. But,
maybe that healing cordial gives you a bit of a...
Yeah, she's dosing. Lucy's dosing in the background. Say no to cordial. But, I kind of liked the environment. I didn't mind that they find a legend that kind of gives them a little hint. It does ramp up the tension, and it's different from in the book, but, I thought it, that little moment where they are going in, and I thought they did a pretty good job. I think I overall enjoyed Caspian giving Eustace a knife, guard something.
I thought that was hysterical.
I thought it was kind of, and I thought he kind of handled it.
Oh, here's a sword. Okay.
Yeah, I thought Poulter did a good job on that. That's okay. I've got it.
I'll take care of you. Don't worry. I'll protect you with my little knife.
Mm-hmm.
That was weird, though. When I didn't quite get it, when Eustace, he looked into the window and he saw the people there, and he just kind of like, whatever.
I know.
Let's go now. Hello. That's what they're looking for.
That was a little weird. It's like it seemed a little extra callous.
Exactly. He never was really like that. I mean,
no. In the book, it wasn't so much that he was callous, it's that he was self-serving. In the book, if he'd seen them, he would have somehow tried to turn it to his own ends.
Like, look at me, I'm such a great searcher, you all owe this all to me.
Or even asking them, where's the British consul,
Have you seen the British consul? I'm in desperate need. That was a little strange. I didn't quite get that. I still don't really. It was really random.
How did you feel the scene kind of overall worked, at least up to that point?
I thought it worked pretty well. That was if they weren't going to do the slow build-up to their being captured, I guess, that was an effective way to do it, I thought.
Yeah, and at that point I was still thinking I thought it was overall working pretty well. And again, I want whatever batteries Edmund's using in that.
I know, like, it's drawer. Like the everlasting battery.
Like, like, wow, it lasts for years and years. And
it's been at least 3 years. It survived a fall off a cliff. It's been jammed into doors. It's knocked people out. It's been thrown off castle walls. What else
is
it
made in England,
done?
I'm telling you. They don't make them like they did in the 1940s.
It's the magical torch. I laughed when I saw that, when I first saw that he had the torch, because I didn't know that they were going to have it in the film until I actually saw the film, I think.
Oh.
And then when I saw it, I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that they have the torch.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I saw some photos from the bell tower set, and so I knew that he had the torch. But no, the funny thing is, like, right, even though I thought it overall worked pretty well, it was right after this that it... I guess... Well, it wasn't even just that. It's like, I quickly realized, I've read the book, I don't know how many times. I really don't know how many times I've read the book and listened to...
I have no clue what's going on.
I do not know what's going to happen next. I mean, in one sense, it was sort of, ooh, I'm kind of intrigued because it's, I don't know what's going to happen, but it wasn't in a good way.
That's sort of how I felt the first time I saw Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe when Lucy gets lost in the river. I was like, I don't remember this. And then 2 seconds later, it was like, oh, all done.
Okay, I want you to describe to me what your thoughts were just as you were watching the scene where Edmund and Caspian meet Lord Byrne, and then they see the mist engulfing the people.
Let's see. Okay, so they're in, Edmund wakes up, or Caspian wakes up in the dungeon. It's like, okay, I can handle this. Talking, looking around, shadowy figure comes out. Who's that? It's Lord Byrne. Oh, crap. Wait a second. That can't be Lord Byrne. He's not supposed to be this old, decrepit person in a dungeon.
It's like, what is this, Count of Monte Cristo?
And then they look out the window, and I see a boat. And I'm thinking, this is not going so well. And then the green mist appears. And I'm pretty much thinking, I am not seeing this. This is not happening. I cannot believe they actually have the soul-eating mist of doom. Like, yeah. So that pretty much was my train of thought.
You panicked when you read the script that shall not be named.
I don't know if I panicked, but I was pretty disgusted.
And Glumpuddle said, nah, it'll never make it in the film.
Oh, but remember all that concept art of all the people walking to the cave, which was admittedly much cooler. It looked way cooler. And we were like, oh, look at this. It's so funny. The hungry moon in the soul-eating cave of doom. And, oh, this is just hysterical. And this is, we'll have a good laugh about this later. And then Miss Emson in the moon was like, oh, man. No. And, yeah, that's the only, that was, we have more Dawn Treader to come. And nothing was as bad as that moment. So I guess I can say that was the worst I have ever felt watching any film ever.
I would certainly not call it the low point of the movie for me, but it was definitely one of the most cheesy moments. I thought, really? I thought, oh my goodness. That was one of the moments. It was so cheesy and so lame. It seemed like from a made-for-TV fantasy movie that I thought, I am embarrassed to be caught watching this scene. There's not that many movies I'm embarrassed to be watching. But there are, like, even...
Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Well, even Star Wars Episode 1 and 2, I can get through most of them. But there's a scene or two in each of those films where I am embarrassed if someone walks in and finds me watching them. And that's how I felt with this scene. It was so lame and so cheesy, I thought. And also, that's the thing, is it was very mechanical, with no real significance to it. It was very
It just is, it devours people's souls.
If they were going
to
get an emotional response out of the audience, they certainly did. I'm just not sure it was the emotional response they were expecting.
Well, which is why they had to have Gale in there, because you have to have something, you know, it's like, oh, you know, 8-year-old girl, if she doesn't tug at your heartstrings, I don't know what will. But it was just, you know, you hear, I'll find you, you know, it's like, you know, Last of the Mohicans, stay alive, no matter what occurs, I will find you, you know, and then you have, you know, Mist, you know. I'll talk more about the Mist later on, and my real, more significant problems with it, but just at this moment, suffice to say, at this point in the film, I just thought, saw this coming, predicted it, it's just as cheesy and ridiculous as I thought it was going to be.
Hindsight is 20/20. When I compare the Mist aspect of the film to the way it was in the early script, the way it is in the film is like the cheap, low-rent version. I mean, in the script, at least it looked cool. The script coupled with the concept art that we got. Because we did get concept
art.
Lady
of the Green Girdle?
Well, not the Lady of the Green Girdle. That, but I remember this one awesome piece of concept art of these, like, zombie people walking into this cave that looked like a mouth, and there was green all over it. And I was like, that looks kind of creepy, and it looks really not like Narnia, but it's visually interesting, which is more than I can say for a random boat going out to the middle of the ocean.
The special effects, it's like, really? I mean, it's smoke. It's not that hard.
I mean, Lost has been doing it for years.
Yeah. I should have yelled out, the smoke monster!
I should have yelled it out. Because, it all makes sense now. The Lone Island is the island. Don't you get it now?
Yes. And Drinian is John Locke. Thank you, Alden Media. Moving on. We're not really moving on. We need to continue discussing. The problem... Okay, so, you know, Caspian's asking that we lords vowed to find the source of the Mist. It just, again, it seems kind of cheesy, you know? That just sort of like, we saw this, and, well, you're not even really... I'm trying to remember. Did Miraz give them a reason for setting sail in the movie?
The Seven Lords?
I don't
recall. I think they mentioned it was just people that didn't agree with him. They were dispatched. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if he gave them a specific reason.
I mean, in the book, you read it, you can kind of see it, you know, unfolding that way. Like, you know, one of the seven says, I've had enough of the sea. I've, you know, met a girl here I like. I'll marry her and, you know, settle down. The six others continue. Three of them say, stop here. And whereas there's disagreements and things here. It's like, it's just like, oh, we must find whatever is eating these people's souls. And it's sort of, I mean, it just seems sort of odd that, you know, like even in, it's like even for the Seven Lords, the whole purpose was survival and fighting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't honor and adventure in the same... I mean, you could say it was maybe honorable to an extent, but, you know, it's not like in the book they find the Dark Island. Ooh, we must find the source of this Dark Island, you know?
It was much more of a banishment. It's like, let's kind of go on a jolly little boat ride and not like, the world's gonna end if we don't find the Mist!
Also, in the book, you know, there's more suspense in terms of what's coming next. I mean, here...
It's the suspense of the unknown, I guess.
Yeah, in the movie, there's suspense in terms of danger. But in the book, Lewis built up suspense in terms of, where things were going, what was happening next. You have the case of the mistaken identity between Caspian and Lord Byrne in the book. But here, I was bored. I mean, I was very bored pretty much through most... Even the bell tower, I wasn't really that... You know, because I knew it was going to happen. I could just see it coming, and I was just very... I was surprised by how bored I was. So, anyways, Caspian and Edmund, you know, they're let out. Lucy's sold. And then the market, Eustace is, you know, told he smells like the rear of a minotaur. Was the audience supposed to be surprised to find the Narnians there in the crowd with the people? I think that they're trying to clue the audience in.
No,
I think it was
not
pretty obvious
really,
with the
I
hoods.
Don't think.
I thought it was painfully obvious that the crew is there.
I didn't start to think that the crew is there until maybe like halfway through the scene. It wasn't really something I really thought about.
You know, one of the problems with, you know, if you read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there's, in many ways, it's very, very realistic. As in, how could they possibly travel with Eustace going behind them? How would they have enough food to feed him? How would he rest, you know, flying? And here, you know, it's like, well, we don't have enough people to conquer the Lone Islands by force. Whereas, you know, I'm looking around at just the crowd you see in the movie, and I'm thinking, how do these people even survive? Is that, it wasn't, aren't they dying from genetic diseases because they're inbreeding too much? And there's so few people. What is this?
You're thinking too much.
That's the thing. I could think by reading the books, and I'm watching a movie where I have to shut my brain off. Okay, you describe the fight scene. You have fun. Tell me what you liked
and
didn't like
about
it.
I don't really remember anything outstanding from the fight scene, except that they
Lucy.
Kind of fight. And
Lucy had the fists of death. She was handcuffed. Like, she punches the guy. He flips over, does a backflip. I thought, I want to see Lucy Pevensey.
I want to have what she's having.
Lucy Pevensey, WrestleMania, come. It'll be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of, like, pitching people off of high things, and, yeah, kind of like, town brawl! Oh, so fun!
It's, okay, here's why I have a big problem with this. In the book, it's so interesting. Caspian has to be clever, he has to use diplomacy, he can't take an approach that just anyone would think of, and it's really very interesting and fun to watch. And it's unique. It's
unique
and it's suspenseful because you're not exactly sure how everything's going to play out. At the time you're reading it, you don't know who's been sold at what point. You don't know if Governor Gumpus is going to completely fall for it. You don't know if the guards are going to... Moment by moment, you're just kind of wondering, and they're wondering with you, you know, well, are the guards going to fall for it? Are they going to be intimidated? And it's one of the best character building moments for Caspian, because you know, you show someone going into a room and you just or into an area just you know, fighting people off, it doesn't really do a lot. But when you have a dialogue scene like that in the book, it does so much.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just so frustrating to see.
Some of the more unique properties of Dawn Treader be brushed aside in exchange for a much more generic, the epic quest of doom or whatever, you know, it was definitely frustrating. Because I understand that with the new plot, they needed to get things moving, and so they couldn't spend much time at the Lone Islands. But with that, they had to sacrifice the whole sequence, really, which is a fairly significant part of the book. You know, it takes up a fair chunk of it, you know, and it's interesting, it's unique, and it's different, and so I was really sad that that had to go. I wish there had been a way to work it in there. That was disappointing.
In the book, violence, yes, there's violence in the books, but it's never kind of an end in itself. It's always something less than desirable, and it's something that people aren't quick to jump to. I mean, you have Reepy Cheap, you know, saying don't fight, push. Whereas here, it's, you know, it's like the entire film is, you know, don't push, fight. I mean, it's, you know, yet you have it at Aslan's Table, you know, there's no place for violence at Aslan's Table, you know, a line in the film. And yet, the first thing that comes to their minds is, well, we'll just fight it out.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas in a sense, it's in the book, even if that's maybe the first thing to jump to someone's mind, it's not necessarily the good thing.
Yeah. So it's definitely disappointing that the unique things that made Dawn Treader different and not your standard epic fantasy fare were definitely pushed to the side. And I think there could have been a way to find a happy medium. And I think they tried, but ultimately it sort of floundered in a bit of lazy filmmaking.
My happy medium, because I understand what you're saying, my happy medium would have been, okay, fine, you can have a little bit of a scuffle when they're first captured. And then maybe introduce a duel between Caspian and Burn, since Caspian offers it in the book. You know, still, I was hoping, and I was hoping against hope, I realized that, I was hoping that as I was watching the film, that somehow, despite everything else, they would have the entire dialogue scene with Governor Gumpus unedited. I wanted, like, one continuous scene of dialogue where it was exactly like the book, and that would have been... And actually, if you go onto YouTube, I went onto YouTube right after seeing the film, and I found the scene of the BBC in Narnia where Caspian, faces Gumpus, and that one scene is actually fairly well done. And there's some other stuff before and after that's just kind of cheesy, and I feel like I'm watching Monty Python. But I posted it on Glumpuddle's Facebook, and he commented saying, "I'm not going to say I like it, but I cannot say it wasn't refreshing."
I think there could have... This is going to sound a little weird, but if they had to have an aspect of the green mist in there, I still think the way that they had it before in the early script worked much better.
Well, working for a movie aside, I mean, this was the point where I... At that point, especially, kind of backtracking a little bit, I knew this is where... I thought, okay, they have, from this point on, despite whatever dialogue with Caspian came earlier, they have altered the purpose of the voyage. And I'll talk more about this later, but this becomes the main purpose from the Lone Islands here. Like, even in the storm later on, when Drinian wants to turn back, Caspian gives him one reason, only one reason, for continuing onward, and that one reason is saving the people who are devoured by the mist.
Yep.
And it's... I don't know, and sometimes, like, and I have... As far as, like, the conclusion of the Lone Islands, there... Here's one of my big complaints. The character development and the way the characters act, from moment to moment, there are really good little things I see, especially with Will Poulter. But even with Will Poulter's Eustace, and I'm not blaming Will Poulter here, there's little moments where I wonder, is this really, how well thought through is this? Because, you know, he's at the Lone Islands, he's asking about the British Consul, and then he gets onto a boat and he assumes it's magical.
Yeah.
You know? Which Eustace wouldn't do. It's just the little moments like that I think about. It doesn't feel like it's a little piece of history. You know, a chronicle is a piece of history, and as I read, you know, Lewis's stories, it sounds like a really elaborate bedtime story that's telling about something that really happened somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of how he tells it, and the film, you know, doesn't really convey that.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Even, you know, when you think about... Okay, you think about the second film. Just the film. Don't even think about the book. And what we know of the Telmarines there. And then, in the third film, we learn that seven of Miraz's colleagues, you could say, seven of the people he knew, were given swords by Aslan to protect Narnia.
And we're like, what?
Yeah, and... Is this at all consistent, people?
Okay, why would they have swords? Why would Aslan have given them swords?
So they can fight.
Why? How do they protect
so
Narnia?
So they can fight.
How do they protect Narnia exactly?
Well, they sure didn't use them on Miraz.
I know.
No, turn around. Go the other way. Go kill Miraz. That's what you're supposed to do.
The swords are by far the worst thing about the film. The mist, I can tolerate. The swords were just stupid.
I disagree.
It was half-baked. They didn't even think it through. So obvious questions like, okay, why would, if Aslan hasn't been to Narnia and no one's seen him and the Telemarines don't even believe in him, why would he have given them swords to protect Narnia? How do they protect Narnia?
Yeah.
Why is it so
significant?
That
part of it.
Blah, blah,
that
blah.
Part of it was
just half-baked and it was stupid.
As far as how it came across in the film, it came across more as a distraction. Yes, it was stupid at the end with Eustace fighting off the mist. You know, it's like, whoo, 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 whoo. You know, it was like Gimli in the extended version of Return of the King. You know, but I think just as far as the presence the Green Mist had, it's like, I felt like I was watching a made-for-TV fantasy film. The point is, I mean, looking back, there were some little moments in the Lone Islands that I liked. I loved the sets. I really did. I thought they looked pretty good. It
looked very Lone Island-y. They did get a good job with most of the sets in the film.
It did. The problem was it looked lonely. It looked lonely because it didn't feel like there were enough people there to really give it a real world, you know? The problem, it was rushed. It was very quickly paced.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to leave me. I think choppy is even a little better. You know, it's like, oh, we saved them. We just finished our little parade march. And then, whoop, who comes around the corner but Lord Byrne in new clothes. And he's got a barnacle sword. I don't know what else to call it. It committed one of the biggest crimes a film can do. I'm not even talking about adaptation here. I've said everything I can say about that. But just as a film, it committed a crime that films are not supposed to commit, and it took me out of the moment. It took me out of the film, and I was continually reminded that I was watching a film.
Yep.
And I understand it's hard to do to have... I think the last film I saw that perfectly, you know, did not ever take me out of the film was probably The King's Speech.
I don't know. I'm pretty good about...
So that's
kind of
my overall conclusion.
I'm pretty good about switching off the internal... stream and just taking a movie for what it is. I don't tend to have a running commentary going on, so that I can't really relate to. It's very rare when I can remember consciously thinking, like, critiquing a movie while I'm watching it. I'll critique it afterwards, but I don't generally critique it while I'm watching it. That's
yeah,
just
I
the
mean,
way
again,
I watch
it depends
movies.
On how well done the film. If it's a really well done film, then
I mean, I can watch
then
cruddy
I don't
movies
really critique
and
it.
I'll still not critique it while I'm watching it.
Yeah, it depends on the film for me. If it's a film that pulls me in, it doesn't even have to be an amazing film. It can be something like The Emperor's New Groove, which is not a fine piece of
cinema,
amazing, but it's just a great movie, and it just it just depends on really how invested I am in the story and what's going on.
It's not a complete waste of your life to watch it. Okay, where were we? We were
just wrapping up our thoughts on the Lone Islands.
Yeah, I think we can all agree on that it was not very good. So, this is probably the only podcast that I will come on about the Dawn Treader and say... and have very little good things to say. Everything else, I have good things, but there's not so much.
See, that's what's funny, is that the last podcast, you know, we were talking about the initial part on the ship, you know, after they're rescued from the water, and when before they reach the Lone Islands, and you know, Dr. Ransom and Glumpuddle, we were all pretty positive in many respects about that part of the film.
I only needed when, you know,
yeah.
Yeah.
And in here, I like to hear you criticize the film. It's just fun.
Oh,
it tickles my fancy.
Yeah, like
so.
Pulling nails, pulling teeth. Really, it gets you that much. Yeah, anyway. You see what I have to suffer through, everyone. I hope you appreciate the things I put up with to give you a less than dire opinion.
Oh, stop complaining. We pay you enough.
Really?
You haven't been getting the monthly checks? Oh my goodness. Hey. Rupert. I'll have my servant fax one to you.
Oh, thank you. You're so kind.
I'll send you an invoice, too.
Oh, good times.
So that is the Lone Islands. And, you know, we'll talk. And there's some other parts in the film later on that I found, I think I enjoyed more than the Lone Islands. So this was
that's a big step up.
No, seriously, it was not so much, it's not that I loathed it so much, it's just that I was annoyed, and saddened, and bored, so. Lone Islands, annoyed, sad, and bored, check.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, Jim Fan, thank you very much. And
you're welcome.
If any of you If any of you want to email us, my email is reallyin@narniaweb.com. And Jim Fans is...
JimFan15@narniaweb.com.
There you go. You do finally have a new one. You got the new one, yes.
Tyrion was so nice after our last podcast with him. He's like, you don't have an email? I was like, no, I don't. Oh, let me get you one.
Ooh, another positive voice. Let's see if we can get Tyrion on. All right. Thank you, Jim Fan. It was fun.
It sure was.